What about ancient prophecies, the apocalypse, the book of Revelation? Let's check in with Chris Putnam when we come back on Coast to Coast AM and take your calls. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We'll take your calls in a second. Chris Putnam with us. Chris, the apocalypse, prophecies, the book of Revelation, what do they all tell you?
Well, George, like we were discussing before, I've been really looking at this account in Revelation 12 about the war in heaven. And yeah, I think that that might be the event that really sets things off. Now, a lot of people are expecting different things as the indicator. But, I suspect that this account where it says the devil and his angels have been cast down to earth, and then they hear a loud voice and it coming from heaven, and it says that, woe to you on earth, for the devil knows his time has come, and he knows his time is short. And so I've been looking at that in correlation to this rise and what I believe to be demonic manifestations. One of the cases that just came out this year, I mentioned right before the break, was in Gary, Indiana. There was a case, this family called the Ammons, and the thing that was kind of unprecedented to me is the official documentation that went along with this case. It's not the kind of thing you normally see. I think in the West, the devil's main strategy has kind of been in line with the movie Usual Suspects, where they had that line that says, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was to convince the world he didn't exist.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Well, I think he did a really good job with that. In a recent Barna poll, this is a poll of Christians, okay, people who identify as Christian, it indicated that like 60% believe that Satan is not a real being, but just a symbol of evil. So that's 60% of people who claim to be Christians who have kind of fallen for the greatest trick the devil ever pulled, in my opinion. I mean, it's clear to me that Jesus believed he was a real personal being, so if you identify as Christian, it seems like you would want to agree with what Jesus taught. Like I said before, I really think that some forms of evil are just so extreme that they really defy a naturalistic explanation. They just aren't adequate for describing things like the Holocaust to me. I really think that that was a demonically inspired event. It just seems so clearly that way to me, especially given, the Jews were God's chosen people in the Old Testament. It just makes sense that he would take his wrath out on them, and Hitler was just the foil through which the devil did that. I mean, I just think that that's a pretty obvious example. But this Ammons case that I mentioned, the thing that made it extraordinary is that in the state of Indiana, you have a Department of Child Services worker and a registered nurse, both testifying in official documentation that they saw a demonized 9-year-old boy glide backwards up a wall and across the ceiling, flip over his grandmother, and land on his feet. This sounds like a scene right out of a Hollywood film, doesn't it?
It sounds like The Exorcist.
It really does. I mean, he walks up a wall, across the ceiling, flips over, and lands in front of his grandma, right in front of these professionals. I mean, a Department of Child Services caseworker and a registered nurse, and they sign official state documents with their testimony. I got a copy of the documents, and they're not afraid to document this and put their names on it and their professional reputations. That's kind of unprecedented. I mean, I've heard stories like that, but very few times will you find, professionals willing to take a risk and actually document that this is what happened. And this was just, really about 6 months or so ago.
Well, Chris, when we all look at this in terms of, Revelation, what's going to happen, it seems to a lot of people that we're in it now. Would you believe that? Would you agree with that?
Well, if you mean the tribulation, I would say no, but I think we're right up against it. It depends on, what you mean by in it and what the it is. There's this 7-year period of time that a lot of prophecy scholars call the tribulation. Really, in the middle of that, at the 3.5-year mark, there's a definitive change that they call the Great Tribulation. So you know, it's possible that you could be in the first 3.5 years and not really realize it. But I would expect that the Antichrist would rise to power before at the beginning of that 3.5 years. And I just don't see anybody that clearly fits that role right now. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation, but I just don't see anybody that's that compelling, that seems, you know, that convincing and winsome to the world at large. Now, he could be there, and I just don't realize it yet, and maybe he just hasn't come into his power, but I'm still looking for that. The other thing I'm looking for is I really think, you know, a lot of the prophecies, if you take them seriously from what the text says, they seem to imply that there is a rebuilt Jewish temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Now, the huge obstacle to that is the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is standing in the same place. And so, you know, until something happens there, I don't see how some of them can be fulfilled, because in 2 Thessalonians 2, the Apostle Paul wrote that, you know, that this Antichrist figure would sit in the temple and proclaim himself to be God. Now, you know, when he said temple, it's pretty clear to me that he meant the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. He was writing a letter to a church in Thessalonica, and, you know, and they understood the word temple to mean a literal building. It was still standing at the time that Paul wrote the letter, so it's really hard to turn that into some kind of allegory. So I kind of suspect that we're going to see that temple rebuilt, and there is a lot of movement in that regard. There's a temple institute in Jerusalem where they actually have made the implements, all the gold implements and whatnot for the Jewish temple have been manufactured. And I've even heard some accounts where they're actually building some of the structures of the temple off-site, so when the time comes, they can actually just move large sections in at once and kind of put it together modularly. Now, I don't know how accurate all that is, but I also heard this year there's a red heifer, which is a pure, you know, red cow that they use.
That's in prophecy too, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, they've been looking for a pure red heifer for a long time. It seems to be a necessary ingredient to get the sacrificial system back up and running. Well, just really a week or two ago, there was a report from the Temple Institute that they found a perfect red heifer. It's the first one they found, so that's a go as well. So a lot of things seem to be falling into place pretty quickly for that to happen.
Okay, let's go to the calls now. As promised, first-time caller Michael in Las Vegas. Welcome to the program. Go ahead, Michael. You are up with us on Coast to Coast. Well, let's see. We've got a little problem here, so...
Hello?
There we go.
Are you there?
Yep. You hear us, Michael?
Yes, I sure do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
What I wanted to ask your guest was, he was talking about demonic forces having influence on these mass murderers. You know, you mentioned like Sandy Hook and Santa Barbara recently. Usually these mass murderers commit suicide. And I was wondering if he had any idea whether they intended to commit suicide before they go on their rampage, or if it's possible that in the midst of committing their horrific act, some type of demonic force overcomes them to the point where they feel they have to take their own lives.
That's a good question, and a lot of different possibilities there, Chris. Which would you say?
It doesn't surprise me that they commit suicide. You know, it really it seems to be the end goal of demons to destroy people. You know, usually I write about spiritual warfare in the book as well, and their strategy, you know, with people in general, just with even, you know, smaller sins, not anything like mass murder, is they tempt you into doing something, and then once you do it, you know, they entice you, they tempt you, you bite, you commit the sin, and as soon as you do it, they turn on you and they start accusing you, and their whole modus operandi is to make you feel like you're worthless. And really, their end goal is to destroy people. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that these people end up committing suicide, because that's how they operate on everybody. I mean, they'll entice a man into cheating on his wife. You know, they'll kind of entice him into doing that. And as soon as you do it, you're a worthless adulterer. You don't deserve to live. That's the kind of thoughts that get planted in the mind really quickly. And, you know, and that's why, you know, Jesus's message of forgiveness and repentance is so important, because all of us fail. And if we were to judge ourselves by, you know, the word Satan actually means adversary. It means accuser. He is the accuser of people, and Jesus is the advocate. That's really how New Testament theology works, that he's our intercessor, and really Satan is our accuser. So, you know, that these people that are used by these demonic forces to do great evil end up killing themselves is pretty much an expected outcome.
What do you think ghostly apparitions might be?
Well, George, that's a big topic in the book as well. And, you know, this is where I take issue with some of the common Christian answers. And because I think that, you know, typically a lot of Christians will say that ghosts are demons in disguise, deceiving people. Now, I wouldn't deny that that happens, but I don't think that that answer is even consistent with the biblical revelation. In the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 28, in the Old Testament, the king Saul actually gets the medium of Endor to rise up the prophet Samuel, who was dead. And, you know, the Bible clearly represents this as Samuel. It calls him Samuel. It describes him as Samuel, wearing his robes. And Samuel delivers. Samuel's not happy with Saul for bringing him up from Sheol. And he delivers a prophecy that Saul is going to be killed in battle the next day, and it comes to pass. So it's very clear to me that that is the apparition of a human being. Now, even more so in the New Testament, the disciples often mention ghosts. When they saw Jesus walking on the water, they were frightened, and the Greek word is they thought he was a phantasma, which is really a word that means a human ghost.
Right.
And then even more telling, I think that this passage is probably the most decisive for me, because I think Jesus implied that ghosts exist. When, after the resurrection, they saw Jesus again, they were scared, and Jesus corrected them. He said, "I'm not a ghost, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones. Look at me, I do have flesh and bones." So not only did he not rebuke them for their belief in ghosts, he distinguished himself from a ghost by his attributes versus a ghost's attributes. Now, implicit in that distinction is that ghosts do exist.
All right, let's take a few more calls. We've got Carol in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. I've been listening to Coast now only for like 2 years, and it has been such an unbelievable, fabulous education.
Well, that's great.
But I've been working on this stuff privately for the last 40 years. And you're talking about the amping up across the board with both the positive and the negative, it seems to me, on a personal level, because I've started using a lot of the techniques that I learned from all the wonderful writers on Coast, and my reading list and my book order list just keeps getting longer and longer, George. It's terrible.
I've got this incredible
backlog, and now, Chris, your work is going on my list of things to get myself informed with. But on a personal level, the amping up is definitely happening. And the way I'm experiencing it is I've started using a lot of inner silence meditation. And that seems to be cutting off the negative voices that come through that I pick up on. And then I hear people on Coast, writers on Coast, talking about the influence of the archons. And it's to the point where when I pay attention, when I'm going to sleep and I'm doing inner silence, if I watch every phase of going under, I can actually feel my soul shift in my body as if it's getting ready to take over. And this fighting the archons in my head all the time seems to be making me gain power to connect with the God part of me, which is my soul. And I was wondering what you think about the influence of the archons causing all of this incredible evil and negativity we're having to endure.
Well, I absolutely do believe that there are forces that influence us. We talked about that a little bit earlier, and, you know, it's evident from the Bible that angels can communicate into our dreams. I think that several passages indicate that demons are able to tempt us by planting temptations and ideas in our head. I think that we have the ability to capture those thoughts and to battle them and to resist those temptations. It's really, there's a point of choice. Most instances where we make bad mistakes and fall into sins, there's a decision that's made in our mind before we ever act on it. You know, when you get that temptation, do you capture that thought and reject it, or do you kind of play it out in your mind and think about how good it might feel or something like that? So there's really a choice that we make that's in our thought life. And that's really where the majority of spiritual warfare occurs. So I think you're absolutely correct in perceiving that battle is largely a mental one. One thing I would caution you against a little bit is that I'm not exactly sure what you mean, you know, when you talk about God within. I'm a little concerned about that because there's a kind of prevalent view within our culture now that's kind of pantheistic. It's kind of, you know, a monistic type idea where all is one and, you know, you find God within yourself. For me, my view, and I think the view of the Bible, is that God is transcendent. Now, he does come to dwell inside people through the Holy Spirit, but ultimately, God is someone that is outside of us. He's outside of nature. He's supernatural. So there's an inner quality and an external quality, but there's a danger in looking within, because a lot of times we'll end up worshiping our own ideas and ourselves. I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but I just want to caution you about that and something to think about.
Let's grab one more call before the break, and let's go to John in Roberta, Georgia. Hey, John, thank you for calling.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you. I'll make it quick.
Sure.
The way I feel is Satan knows that he's on the countdown. You know, he doesn't have very much time left, and he's working overtime. And with all the evil things that are happening today, children killing themselves and like I said, he knows that his time is limited, and he's really, really working hard.
He's got his back against the wall, Chris, huh?
Yeah, I suspect that's the case. That's really what I'm arguing right from the Revelation chapter 12, where it says, "Woe to you on earth, where the devil knows his time is short." And I think that is likely a very near event where the Bible describes it, he's literally cast physically to earth. Now, you know, it just depends on how literal you want to interpret that text. You know, you could take a very literal view of it and see him coming down as a physical being. Now, could that possibly work under the cover story of some sort of extraterrestrial manifestation? Maybe. I mean, some people would take it to that. I mean, it could be that, you know, it's something along the lines of many popular science fiction stories where the devil, you know, kind of appears and masquerades as an alien. I don't know if that's the case, but I think that might be a good cover story were that to happen.
Chris, as the clock gets us here, we'll come back for a final segment. But again, what websites would you recommend? We've got links already, of course.
Yes, www.supernaturalworldview.com is the site for the book, and it has a link to the special deal where you get all three books for the price of one. My other website is www.logosapologia, that's logosapologia.org.
Okay, we're going to come back. We will take final calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, those of you listening to us on WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina, I will be there sometime in the morning. It's going to be a quick night after this program. I've got a major event at the seminar, it is called. A number of corporate people have asked for me to speak because they want to learn more about you. So we're going to be doing that, and then I'll fly right back to St. Louis, and we'll do the program out of the cave. It could be a cage sometimes. And also on our program tomorrow, Doug Fine joins us for the first couple hours as we talk about the hemp revolution, followed by David Young, who is channeling George Harrison. Yep. the Beatles. So we will do all of that on our next Coast to Coast program. And when we come back in a moment, we'll take some final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up with Jeremy, truck driving in Indiana, first-time caller. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Hey, I got a question. Could the reason why there's not a whole lot of people having ESP today be through, like, persecution and teaching through, like, Christianity, Islam, and whatnot, any other religion, on why not so many people have it today?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, the evidence for it is actually becoming more compelling. I don't know that I could say, you know, that any less people have it today than any other time in history, because it's largely probably an unreported phenomenon. We don't really have any good numbers on how many people do. But I think you're right in that, you know, the church has probably made a lot of mistakes in the past by demonizing this phenomenon, you know, with really broad brushstrokes. You know, if it is a natural ability, and it seems to be in large part, you know, it would tend to make people go underground, you know, especially in the days when there were things like the Inquisition and witch trials and things like that, because anyone that demonstrated sorts of abilities would probably be accused of being a witch. Now, you know, this is, I think, is really unfortunate, and I argue in the book that that's not necessarily the case. But, you know, unfortunately, what has probably happened historically is that, you know, say you're someone who has some kind of precognitive ability or clairvoyance or something like that, and it's just a natural ability. It's just something you're born with. Now, you realize that you can do this, but you also realize that if you tell the priest, or, you know, you tell the church, that they're going to brand you a witch, so you don't tell anybody. And then the only people you probably can talk to are people who are involved in the occult, because they will accept you. So it tends to make people go that way. Now, that's unfortunate, because it doesn't necessarily attach to the occult, but it forces people to attach themselves that way because it's the only choice they were given. And that's the way it's been historically. Now, in my book, I actually cite many cases of Christians who have, you know, these sorts of abilities that are used in an absolutely a benign way, and things that really bear good fruit. And there's really no justification for demonizing the sorts of things that I discuss in the book. Now, in the Bible, there are, you know, warnings against things like divination and necromancy and sorcery. So, you know, there are good reasons to steer away from those sorts of things. But, you know, some of the things, like, especially like precognitive dreams or premonitions, where people aren't even necessarily intentionally doing it, you know, I just don't think that it's a valid thing to connect that to the occult or demons or anything. So there is an important distinction that needs to be made, and Christians should be more discerning in how they label things and not be so reactive and blanket demonizing of things like that.
Chris, do you think you have to be spiritual in order to be intuitive?
I certainly think that it helps. You know, in the Bible, they talks about spiritual gifts, and they're, you know, the gifts of discerning spirits, gifts of discernment that necessarily, you know, entail something very much like what you're talking about.
We've got Rachel in Des Moines, Iowa now. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for calling.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a couple things. First off, because I really like you, George, and you seem like a decent guy, I want Chris to tell you why it'd be a horrible, horrible idea to do the Ouija board on air, what you could be opening people up to. And second of all, I kind of have some abilities, but when I was like in junior high, I came home from school. My sister's 9 years older than me, and she's like, oh, I'm going to read you tarot cards. And I'm like, no, I don't want nothing to do with that. It's demonic. Get away from me. And she goes, oh, I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm like, whatever. And then that night, in the middle of the night, I swear to God, I could not breathe, and I heard all these voices, like hundreds of voices, saying, we hate you. We've always hated you. We hate you. And I said, Jesus, please help me. And it stopped just like that, and I turned the light on and slept with the light for the rest of the night. But ever since that, anything to do with anything spiritual at all just scares me to death.
React to that, Chris, and we'll talk about the Ouija board right after that. Go ahead.
Well, certainly. I mean, it sounds to me like, yeah, that when people do intentionally practice occult things, they open the door, you know, to allow these outside spiritual influences to come in. And, you know, that's dangerous because you don't really know what you're dealing with. You know, the Ouija board is pretty much an open invitation. You know, it historically has been associated with all kinds of demonic phenomenon that result from it. So, there's a big warning about trying to contact the dead in the Bible. And, you know, I don't think that God put those warnings in there because they don't work. I think he put the warnings there because those kind of things do work. You know, the fact that he lists, you know, all these sorts of things not to do tells me that they're serious warnings. God doesn't trade in nonsense. So why would he warn us against necromancy and divination and sorcery if there was no such thing as those things? So they're not nonsense. The warnings are there because they do work.
And I don't have any plans to do a Ouija board show like that, Chris. I was going to have a Ouija board on several years ago, 2007, and I canceled that show. And since then, I'm being bombarded with folks who want me to go ahead with it. The majority want me to do this. I am not planning to do it at this point. Nobody's convinced me otherwise. I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
Let's go to Terry in Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Terry. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chris and George.
Hi, Terry.
I remember watching a movie called Omega Factor, and they had the Dome of Iraq getting blown up in that movie, and they were saying that in the movie that the Antichrist will come from the European Union, first president. What do you think about that answer? Question.
Well, a lot of people have speculated that the Antichrist would be from a European background because there's a prophecy in Daniel chapter 9. It's a famous prophecy called the 70 weeks prophecy. And there's a reference that says that from the people, it talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. And it makes a reference to what many people believe is the Antichrist, and it says that he will come from those people. Now, for that reason, some prophecy scholars have, you know, speculated that would be of Roman descent, which would make him European, like you're saying. Now, that's very much highly debated. So it's not necessarily a shoe-in whatsoever. And, you know, even if you take that prophecy in that interpretation literally, I think Chuck Missler has pointed out that the Roman Empire actually split into two. And, you know, you could even argue that Turkey, which became Constantinople, was the eastern leg of the Roman Empire. And for that reason, you could say he was Muslim. So, you know, even that interpretation could be debated. But, you know, I don't know that we can really say that with any degree of certainty.
Let's go to Peggy, Prescott, Arizona. Peggy, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi,
hi,
Chris.
Peggy.
Hi. I wanted to draw a correlation between Sandy Hook and Santa Barbara.
Okay.
The director of the Hunger Games, the second director, was okay. And then in Sandy Hook, the author of the Hunger Games is Suzanne Collins. Sandy Hook is the head of is the seat of the Satanic Church, I understand. Did a little research on it. Anyway, so the second director of the Hunger Games, Suzanne Collins, who's the author of the Hunger Games, and lives in Sandy Hook. Sandy Hook was a false flag, and I think the Santa Barbara killings were a false flag as well to get the guns. And all of mainstream media seemed to just shore it up that it was a false flag to get the guns. And it seems like Santa Barbara seemed like a movie the kid was reading cue cards out the car window, and Sandy Hook was seemed like a movie as well, and I'm seeing a correlation there.
Peggy, do you think they were like Manchurian program candidates, these people?
I think the kid might have been, yeah.
What do you think of that, Chris?
I do. Honestly, Chris, I would like to have your take on this.
All right, thanks, Peggy. That is demonic, if that's the case, Chris.
Yeah, either way, you know, it's consistent with it being demonically inspired. You know, but honestly, I haven't seen anybody successfully taking our guns away yet. I know that a lot of people want to, but it really hasn't happened, you know, as a result of that. I'm sure that the people that are, you know, promoting gun control use these events to those ends, but it really hasn't worked out for them quite yet. It's a little hard for me to connect those two events as false flags. You know, I don't know. I don't really have a strong opinion on that. If so, you know, I would suspect that the conspiracy is probably more in the spirit realm than it is this worldly. It's hard for me to imagine our government being that crass that they would wipe out 20 kindergartners.
Understand. Steve in Los Angeles. Hi, Steven.
Hi, George. Hi, Chris. Hey, hey. You mentioned earlier that about the temple being rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I've been interested in for a while. And all the dates of the books of the New Testament are problematic for me. I couldn't imagine if they wrote the first book about World War II in 2005, I might have a little problem with that. But, you know, this book was probably written 51 AD, Thessalonians, something like that, 50 years after the death. That's quite a while for a book to be written about a particular subject, any subject. And at that point, the temple had not been destroyed, so it was raised,
right.
And it was alive, that temple. And I don't think that Paul had any idea that temple was going to be destroyed. So when he made that statement, I mean, when I read these letters that Paul wrote, I just never got the impression that he was really a prophet. I looked at him more as a great orator and a bringer of the gospel to the Gentiles, where the disciples more or less brought the gospel to the Jewish people. And I just never really got the sense that he was a prophet, that he would know that the temple was going to be destroyed and be rebuilt. And so I would think that he would be just as surprised as anybody else when the temple was destroyed.
And then, you know, that might be the case. You know, I think the event Paul is talking about in 2 Thessalonians, that, you know, he probably got some of that directly from Jesus. In Matthew 24, Jesus speaks of something called the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel as a future event. Now, the thing that's interesting is that we have some typology, because there was an abomination of desolation that happened in the past when Antiochus Epiphanes, a Greek leader, he actually slaughtered a pig on the altar in the Holy of Holies in the Jewish temple around in the 160s BC, and that was the first abomination of desolation. You know, of course, Jews don't like pigs, so the idea of doing that was really repulsive to them. He also set up a statue of the pagan god Zeus in the temple. So that was the first abomination of desolation. So I think what Paul is describing in 2 Thessalonians is really kind of filling in the details of what Jesus predicted as a future event that would directly precede his second coming. So Paul is describing a defiling of the temple when this Antichrist figure proclaims himself to be God in the temple. So I think it's the same sort of thing that Antiochus did, played out as a future event. Whether Paul knew that the temple would be destroyed or not is really immaterial. For that to actually happen, there needs to be a temple, or there really can't be a desolation of the temple.
Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana. First time caller, Pete is with us. Pete, thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. How's it going tonight?
Good, Pete. Thank you.
Listen, George, I want to thank you guys for Coast to Coast, first of all, because I've been listening since 97, since the Ebola breakout. I think it was 97 when Art was, and you guys were telling the truth 2 days before anybody else.
Yes, absolutely.
So you're very accurate in reporting. My only comment really was about when the war in heaven took place. I disagree mainly because Jesus said that the devil was a lion roaming about the world devouring who he can. And so that, and he said it in the present tense. And he was casting out demons at that time, too, which shows that demons had been around for a long time. So I believe it goes back, and I do believe that the Earth is only 10,000 years old. There's enough scientific evidence. There's enough statistical, mathematical probabilities with the size of how long it takes to make a protein from one DNA strand, et cetera, and other just a wealth of scientific evidence that the scientific community ignores because it's not convenient for what they want to believe, that the Earth is only 10,000 years old. And I think in God's presence, in God's mind, and in Satan's mind, that is a short time. And if I could get a comment, I'll go off the air. And thank you so much for such an interesting show.
You're welcome. Okay, let's let you wrap that up for us if you would like to, Chris.
Certainly. Well, you know, I actually, when we talked about this prophecy in Revelation 12, you know, I said that at first I used to agree with your caller that I tended to think that it was something that happened about the time of the cross. Now, the fact that Satan has access to Earth, it's actually 2 Peter or 1 Peter. It's Peter's writing that says that the devil is like a roaring lion. But the fact that the devil can come to the Earth doesn't mean that he's been cast to the Earth to no longer reach heaven. In the book of Job, they asked the devil where he's been. He said, I've been roaming to and fro on the Earth. So he had access to the Earth, and he also had access to heaven. So the war in Revelation 12 is where he's totally banned from heaven and he can't get back. And I don't think that that's the case now because he's still serving as the accuser. I think that he's still up there accusing people right now, and Jesus is interceding for us. The idea that he's no longer in the role of accuser doesn't make sense to me. And also, if you study Revelation 12, there is a hymn that is sung in heaven when he is cast to earth. Now, if you read that hymn carefully, there's quite a few things that the hymn is celebrating. And I don't think that all those things have come to pass yet. And so for that reason, I still think that the war in heaven is a future event or that it is ongoing right now.
Indeed. Chris, thank you for being on the program. Good luck. The Supernatural Worldview. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galante, Will Wilkerson, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.